Welcome to the Iron Basketball Podcast, the Pick Control Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. Matt Moore, ball is out of bounds on you.
You know, I was talking to my wife this morning about everything that happened last night. And she was like, so what do you think? What happened? And I was like, I don't really care. And she was like, she stopped. She's like, wait, you flip out over everything. I was like, yeah, I don't really care. I have no hot sports takes on this. And she's like, you honestly don't care about, like, about who was right in the situation. I can see both sides. I think both sides have a regular, reasonable argument. And she was like, are you on Prozac? What's happening? You had an excellent breakdown of the entire debacle.
Thank you. I would like to credit that to the detective work of Danny Savitsky, who is who basically posted the rules on Twitter. And I took those. I gave him credit. And then I just put my hot sports take on it. It was not even a sports take. It was just... all right, so here's what I saw. I saw Reggie Jackson holding the ball with two hands. I saw Matt Barnes slap the crap out of his left hand. The ball went out of bounds off his right hand. And to me, looking at the rule, that's, you know, that's Thunderball. Like, I get the argument of, but it went off his right hand, not his left hand. It's like, right, but the contact happened when both hands are on the ball. And so if we're going by... And if your only argument, or there are two arguments that I got. One was, but the rule says the hand. If we're arguing over articles in a sentence, that's insane. Like that's to me, that's insane. I have no problem if you think, well, the spirit of this and the letter of this is such to where I think it should be clip or ball. That's fine. But if your argument is coming down to it says the hand, well, it doesn't say the hand. It doesn't say point of last point of contact with the ball. Like, it doesn't say any of that. I think it's ambiguous enough to where you can look at what the ruling was. Well, not the ruling. You can look at what the outcome was and say, yeah, that's justified. And then some people are like, well, what if it had gone off his leg? I'm like, well, then it's a completely different rule. That's not the same thing. Like, so don't, that's an argument I don't get. But the problem, I think, is that the explanation Doc Rivers and the Clippers got from Tony Brothers was absurd. Like, that was just ridiculous. There was inconclusive evidence. Really? Because it looked pretty clear to everybody else.
And then, at the same time, like, one of the Clippers were saying, maybe it was the Clippers were saying, the Brothers told them, we got an angle, and from what we saw, it was off you. And then he goes and he says it was inconclusive.
Right.
Like, not to go to JFK Zapruder on this thing, but... a little weird when there's like reports of a second ball slapper on the grassy knoll,
right?
And then, which that's an interesting.
I'm not even going to make the Reggie Evans joke here. I'm just not.
And then all of a sudden it's inconclusive, you know. And then nobody's really mentioning hands part of the ball, which that happened in 2009 in the game with Pau Gasol, and I was like, what are you talking about? Like, this is insane. And I wrote an entire post on it, and then Tim Frank of the NBA got back to me. He's like, well, actually, here's the rule. And then I was like, ball is part of the hand? Is actually a thing? And he's like, yep.
I had somebody, because I said, I made a joke about hand is part of the ball or something like that. And someone on Twitter last night was like, that's a made up rule in old man's pickup game. I was like, no, it's literally a rule in the NBA rule book.
And there was here's, like, the link.
And then it was just a, well, yeah, but still. Well, I don't know what to tell you. And I think the fact that his right hand made last contact with the ball is completely irrelevant. Like, I just find it to be irrelevant because he had both hands. Like, if he had had the ball in his right hand and his left hand got slapped and then it goes out, yeah, then it should be a foul. But if you don't call the foul, then it's off the Thunder. And the replay, the call book or whatever the supplementary piece of literature the NBA released before the season, there's an example in there that says, yeah, that should stay Thunder ball. And so, like, based off the rules that we have, I think the outcome was correct. I think the explanation from Tony Brothers was crap. I think the officiating that was done in that game was crap. I think Tom Washington's a really good referee. I think Bennett Salvatore and Tony Brothers are terrible. And I thought I don't know who had the majority of the bad calls, and maybe it ended up being Tom Washington in the game, but I just thought that Salvatore and Brothers officiated a horrible game, and there were a lot of missed calls. I don't think that was one of them. And I don't like this idea that, oh, the Clippers were robbed. No, that's crap. They played horrible. You're up 13 points. with 4 minutes to go. You're up 7 points with 43 seconds to go or 49 seconds to go. You lost that game.
I have sympathy for Doc Rivers from this perspective, which is I think if you coach long enough, and by long enough, I mean like 3 weeks in the NBA, you start to understand this stuff just happens. Like everyone's like, how could you lose that game? And I'm like, well, if we say almost after every game, how could you lose that game? Maybe this is just a function of what happens in basketball, where two really good teams are going to eventually over the course of, and then maybe that's, the, I think it's one of the great things about the NBA is that it's just long enough. If this game was three quarters, the Clippers are the Clippers have won, right? And they're up 3-2. But the game is always just long enough for the other team to slowly start to get back in it if they are really at playing at the same level.
Yeah, and I understand Doc Rivers' frustration. He has skin in the game, right? Like he is coaching. If they go up 3-2, they're not guaranteed to go into the conference finals, but it's a likelihood. And right. and the explanation he got from Tony Brothers and everything, like, that was crap. And so I understand feeling like you got cheated out of it. But everything, like, I thought Blake Griffin's comments were really mature and composed, saying, hey, I thought it was off them, but we can't put ourselves in that situation. And that's the thing I always come back to is you play well enough or you play poorly enough to put yourself in situations like that, right?
Yeah.
Like, they played poorly enough to make that a situation where that possibility happened, and I think it was the right outcome. I think Chris Paul got fouled a couple of times in the last couple minutes or in the last minute, and I think that he also made some really poor decisions. And all of those combined, I don't like assigning blame to one moment or one player when you have a 48-minute team game. I just think it's a crap scapegoat mentality, and I just don't like that. And that's me being elitist or whatever, or narcissistic, or I don't know what the hell it's me being, but I hate that aspect of our sports culture.
I find it, like, again, I guess I get why. I'm kind of with you in that it's not even so much like don't blow a 13-point lead where I'm just like, don't foul Westbrook on the three.
Right.
Like, don't foul Westbrook on the three.
Did you think he fouled him? Because that was a point of contention as well. I thought he got him on the elbow personally.
I thought he got under him too much. I don't think he gave him enough room to come down.
Okay.
I think he got him on the elbow. And it's like, and again, have you not noticed the 4-point plays have kind of been a thing? Like,
that's a weird thing that you can't challenge a three anymore.
Right?
That's a weird adjustment to the game.
But even then, I keep going, you want Russell Westbrook taking that pull-up three. I love Russell Westbrook, but you want him taking that shot.
What
Let him shoot.
Horrible, horrible decision.
Yeah. And if he hits it, you tip your cap, but then you also go and get the ball. I don't really blame him. I blame the inbound a little bit. Like, inbounders got to see who's going there.
Right.
It was Barnes, right? Barnes is the inbounder?
That sounds right to me.
I'm going to blame Matt Barnes because I like blaming Matt Barnes for things. So,
sure.
It was his, you know, and Westbrook made a great play on the ball. He could have probably gotten a call there, too.
Westbrook. Yeah, I thought Westbrook fouled Chris Paul, but there didn't seem to be a whole big to-do about it. But, right. Like, in real time, I was like, oh, he fouled him, and then no call. I was like, uh-oh, what happened?
Right. And then they still had the ball and the chance to win, you know, and Chris is really hard on himself afterwards and that he's a leader and I feel bad for him and he knows it was his fault. But, yeah, I mean, it really was. It was, you know, it was let the inbounds get stolen, fouled Westbrook on the three, didn't complete the final, didn't score on the final possession when he had the jumper. And he had the jumper, he had the floater, and for some reason he's passing to Blake Griffin underneath. I don't know. Like,
oh, he had, oh my God, he had such a great hesitation move too, where I thought that pull-up jumper was coming right after it because he had Ibaka completely off balance. It was just a great move, and then he fumbled it. Reggie Jackson reached in, and then I couldn't tell if he was passing or if he was actually going up for the shot and just lost the ball because of maybe that reach in.
Yep.
Weird end of the game, and I just don't like blaming the refs. I thought the refs were crap, but I didn't think it was one-sided. I thought they were just bad.
I agree, they were just bad. And they've had I did think it's interesting that they keep having problems with the Clippers specifically. And
yeah, what was it, two or three games in that Warriors Clippers series were just horribly officiated. Maybe two games of this series have been really, really bad. And maybe that's just a thing of all the flopping and exaggerating. And I'm not into this whole like all the Clippers do are flop. Like I think that's dumb, but they do sell calls a lot, and maybe that's just screwed up the wiring of the officials.
Yeah, I mean,
their games.
The fan answer is gonna be well, they're floppers and they're dirty, but well, no, not really.
Yes, they flop. I don't think it's an exorbitant amount more than your typical team.
I think I do feel like they're honestly so worried about an emotional eruption that they're concerned that they're really trying to keep it under control.
Yes.
A little bit too much, to the point where I'm kind of like, guys, y'all realize nobody on this team is actually going to fight anybody, right? Like,
right. There might not be a single fighter on that court. Because we know Steven Adams doesn't fight anybody. He just takes punches. He's like Homer Simpson in that boxing episode.
Right.
I can't take credit for that. Someone mentioned that to me on Twitter a few days ago.
Like Perkins, I think Perkins would beat some ass.
I don't think he would. I really don't. I think he's a, like I just after the Zeebo incident, I thought he doesn't really want to fight someone as tough.
Maybe he
would fight Blake because he doesn't feel Blake is a fighter.
And then, I mean, I do think if you push Steven Adams, I'm kind of worried that if you push Steven Adams far enough, that he would just basically snap and kill everyone.
Sure.
You know, I was trying to explain that to Grizzlies fans because they're like, if Zeebo hit him, he'd feel it. He's Steven Adams, and I'm like, that dude played New Zealand rugby. He doesn't care.
I'm almost 95% sure that he doesn't have nerve endings in his face.
I'm just waiting for it to find out, like, his brain is actually, like, in his stomach. Like,
he gets punched in the stomach and gets a concussion.
He's like Kang from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Right.
Like, he's just a robot being operated by a tiny brain-like creature.
Sure.
Yeah, so I don't know. It's a crazy game. It's a crazy ending. It's also funny to me because I'm kind of like, everyone's like, oh, like Doc was like, it's a series defining call. And I'm like, you guys are winning game six. Like, I feel pretty confident the Clippers are going to win game six.
Yeah.
If you get to, I feel like if you get to the second round, let me caveat that. If you get to the second round in the Western Conference, you have to have a level of adversity response.
Yes.
Like the Thunder could have folded. They came back and beat the Grizzlies. The Spurs could have folded. They came back and beat the Mavericks. You know, Houston didn't have that, and they didn't advance. If Houston had any sense of adversity whatsoever, I feel like they would have won that series in seven.
The Clippers. They faced a weird adversity in the first round, but they still faced it, yeah.
They faced a ton. My original headline on yesterday's preview was adversarial adversity in the modern age, because both of these teams have gone through crazy stuff in these last couple of weeks. The Clippers more so than the Thunder. Like, everybody kind of forgets the Sterling thing was obviously like a nuclear bomb, but they got hit early because they lost game one when Blake Griffin got tagged, only played 19 minutes. That was like a disaster in your home opener
right, for
the playoffs run when you're supposed to be a title contender. They respond from that and win game two and three. Sterling hits. They lose four. They come back. They win five. Then the emotional response from the Warriors of losing game five, they win game six, force game seven. The Clippers respond again. They win on the road. And then OKC takes two straight. They come back from 20 down, and then they lose this one.
Right.
Like, nothing – I feel like, you know, if you're the Clip – and Paul seemed really bothered by it, but I also kind of feel like you got to – you just like the Thunder had to – like, you got to feel really good about where you're at from the perspective of, you know – here's what's crazy. So the Clippers completely outplayed them in game one, and they outplayed them for three quarters of game five.
Right.
The Thunder have outplayed them for about 2.75 games of the series. They outplayed them for games two, three, and three quarters of game four.
Right.
So it's like, if we're doing a scorecard, it's like 2.75 to 2.25.
Right
now. And that's really close, you know? And so I don't think that there's any reason to be like, the game is up, like the series is over, like they can't recover. I'm like, no, they're going back home. Yeah. They know that they should have won that game. They know they can play with this team. And I feel like we've gotten two really great games out of the Thunder, and I feel like we've only gotten, honestly, I feel like we've only gotten one really good game out of the Clippers, and that was last night. I feel like game one was more Chris Paul just had a night.
Yeah, you know? I mean, Chris Paul went, what, 8 of 9 from three?
Yeah.
And I think the Clippers will win game six. And then at that point, like, I know history is on the side of the game seven home team, but I think these two teams are so evenly matched. I don't think it will matter.
Home court's irrelevant in these playoffs.
Yeah, like
it doesn't matter anymore.
I don't think it'll matter. I don't think, like, normally I'm just like, hey, I'll take the home team in game seven. But in this case, like, I don't feel that way. I might pick depending on how the Clippers win game six, assuming they do, I might think the Clippers close it out on the road.
Like, I'm writing a post about this right now about Gortat's comment. Gortat actually said last night, unfortunately, we have to go home. They're 1-3 at the phone booth in the playoffs.
Like, he also said, I'm proud, I'm Wizard. Michael Lee tweeted that out. I just died. That's right on par with Monte Ellis's I'm a Warriors, I'm always gonna be a Warriors.
These teams, I mean, Indiana last night gets housed at Baker's Life. Like, I mean, the Pacers have been awful in that building.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, I'm really starting to be like, is there something, like, I have noticed this ever since the regular season collapsed. The crowd's been very much like, okay, don't screw this up. And then, like, they got off to a bad start last night, and immediately they were like, oh no, you guys are doing this again. And, like, you need your crowd to be like when the Warriors go down, the crowd goes ballistic when they pull within like seven.
Yeah, I mean, it's always cliche, but there are some crowds, and the Warriors are one of them, that have like a legitimate six man with the crowd. Right? Like Thunder, Blazers, Warriors. Like, these are all teams that, like, have a legitimate six man. I don't feel like the Wizards or the Pacers have that.
Like, instead of their six man is Andrew Bynum, basically.
I mean, if you're the Wizards, don't you give Andrew Bynum courtside seats to game six? And why would he decline those? He doesn't care. He would love to troll the Pacers right now.
Even, like, if it right was across split. From their bench, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Give him courtside seats across from the bench. How could you not do this if you're Ted Leonsis?
We've got a whole night plan for you. A limo's going to pick you up. You're going to go bowling. Take it to the game.
Your point in Campfire last night, or maybe you tweeted out, I can't remember, but your point of, wow, when the Pacers lose, they really self-destruct now.
Yeah, like that's what's amazing is, you know, and Twitter loves freaking out about them. It's crazy because Twitter likes freaking out over them more than they like freaking out over the Knicks at this point. Like, they flipped out this.
I think it's a thing of, like, it's all this, like, oh, the media props them up. Like, no, they were legitimately, like, really good. But it is this thing of, like, you have to earn our respect, which is probably always been the case. It's just, it's in your face now when you're on Twitter, right? And so, the Pacers legitimately have to beat the Heat and have to win a championship in order to get respect. And even then, you don't really know that they're going to get it, because then it's like, well, let's see if it was a fluke and you can back it up with a second one, you know? Like, it is this weird, like, this proving ground, which probably doesn't matter, but at the same time, like, it definitely controls the narrative and the response to what's going on.
Well, I mean, like, here's a great example. Like, if the Heat were in the same position, it would be like, oh, well, they just didn't have it. They'll win game six, but, you know, whatever. It'd be some people be like, ah, you lost, ha, ha, ha. But there wouldn't be people being like, you're going to lose, because, you know, that's the thing is everyone's freaking out, and I'm like, they're still up 3-2. They got to win one of two games.
Right. I mean, if the Heat lose tonight, we're probably not going to hit the panic button on them, right?
No, it's going to be like, oh, God, they have to go back to Barclays.
Oh no.
Ooh.
The quiet, the eerie quiet will throw them off.
The eerie quiet. Man, and there's like an article that came out about, and like Adam Silver was like, is it always like this? Like the crowd was rocking. I'm like, what? The pumped in crowd noise was rocking? Like, and of course, Nets fans have gone down the Lakers Heat path of, well, the upper bowl is really great. You know what? That's still half the arena.
Yeah.
Like, I get the good fans are priced out, and that's, I think it sucks. I don't think it's like, I honestly wish that they would kind of randomize it a little bit more, and like, I think it'd be cool to be like, no, if you know, you enter into a lottery, and if you pay this amount for tickets, you have a chance to get into the lower bowl, because we'd like to have people that actually care and show up on time. But the biggest thing I think for Nets fans is you don't get to talk about Lakers fans, and you don't get to talk about Heat fans. Oh, and also, Oklahoma City Thunder fans have lost their card, because those guys left, and even if it was a small portion of them, Darnell Mayberry tweeted it, Royce Young tweeted it, got people left when the Thunder were down 7 with a couple minutes to go. And I don't blame them for it, because I said this last year when the Heat fans left. Like, I would have bailed. I thought it was over.
We were planning our coverage of it. We were planning our coverage of how the Spurs won the championship, like, with like a minute left. Like, we all thought it was over.
The best part about that entire Game 6 experience was actually being on press row. Like, one, watching it unfold was incredible. But then watching that shot and everyone freaks out, and then there's this pause in the media room as everyone goes, I have to change my flight. Like, there's this mass opening of orbits as everyone tries to cancel their flight that they had just booked. Like, guys had been booking flights for the entire fourth quarter. Like, like calling their wives, like, I'm coming home, sweetheart.
Fire up the DVR.
My wife threw things. She was like, ah!
I think, I had something about the... Oh, I'm just happy that Jay and Bay are still going to the games.
I was gone and then trying to catch up when this thing erupted. What happened?
Do you know who Solange is?
No.
I think it's Beyonce's sister. Okay, I don't fully know, but
I thought it was some sort of line of tanning places, like salon. Like, am I wrong? I feel like there actually is a Solange tanning.
Like a combination of salon and orange.
Yeah.
Yeah. There might be. Maybe that's her business. I don't know. There's like security camera of her, like, physically assaulting Jay-Z in an elevator after the Met Gala. And it just, I don't know, it's like a 2 or 3 minute video of her just like trying to get at Jay-Z, kicking him, punching him, security's handling her or whatever. And so, you know, there are rumors of why it happened. I don't know what to believe. There are rumors that, you know, Rihanna's involved or whatever. I don't know what's going on. But I do know that they still showed up to the game. And if Jay-Z was still the owner of the Nets, like, I would be running the elevator doors play constantly and calling it out as that. If I were the Heat. But the Heat, that doesn't really affect him anymore, so.
Well, that's...
I wish crazy bearded Jake Gyllenhaal was showing up to every game. That was a delight in game... What was it, game 3?
Yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah, crazy bearded Jake Gyllenhaal. I'm a fan.
I ran into him twice. Not like, hey, how you doing? But...
Like you were in his bushes?
Like, I was at this party in Austin, Texas, and like bumped into him, and he was like, "Oh, excuse me," and I was like, "No problem." And he's like walking away, Jake Gyllenhaal. And then I was in Chicago with a friend, and he was filming a movie, and we accidentally wandered into like the area we were not supposed to be in because we just weren't paying attention. The security guards weren't paying attention. Yeah, that was weird. It was during he was filming something terrible. I don't remember what, but yeah, that's my story.
Cool.
Also. We need to remove win or go home. It's now win and go home and then lose.
Right.
That's my adjustment on that. Stan Van Gundy's back.
Yeah. Stan Van Gundy's back with the Pistons. I did not see this coming.
That happened so fast.
And the entire time I just thought like, oh, he's clearly leveraging the Warriors to get, you know, more power or more say or whatever. Nope, he's just going to take it. And it makes sense.
Yeah,
it really does make sense.
Well, it seems kind of crazy because it seemed like I don't know if it's Gores or Gores, the Pistons owner had somebody who was like in touch with him, and then was like, "Oh, I'm sure you wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't be interested. Like, we give you basketball operations, but I'm sure you wouldn't be interested." And he's like, "I'll be very interested in that." What? Tom. And then Tom like immediately was like, "How much do you want? All of the money in all the world." Like,
how many RoboCops can I get you?
It went from like, oh, you know, the Warriors are in hot pursuit of Stan Van Gundy. Like this should happen. Like Kerr's gonna go to New York, Van Gundy will go to the Warriors. Like that's gonna be it. And then give it to Gores. Like he just like jumped on it and was like, money, power, whatever you want. And I like this because for years I've said I was always kind of opposed to the idea of coach president of basketball operations. I think it's a very risky mechanical move because yes. You wind up in a lot of trouble with guys having too much authority and not being able to see the big picture. You essentially need somebody who doesn't see guys in practice. I firmly believe this. Like, coaches get way too attached to how a player behaves in the locker room, on team buses, in the arena, with staff, and in practice. Like, they see all that stuff and they're like, oh, what a leader. What a good guy. Like, this happens constantly. And they tend to forget the fact that what happens when they're in games is what needs to take precedent over everything else.
Right.
I don't feel like Van Gundy's going to suffer from that because I just don't think he cares, you know?
Yeah, there are certain guys like Pop, Rivers, although Rivers, a little bit of a shaky offseason and trust in certain guys, but, you know, I get it. But I know some people are critical of the moves he made once he took over the Clippers. But Pop, Rivers, Stan Van Gundy, like those are all guys I trust with that kind of responsibility. And I think that, you know, he's gonna apparently hire Otto Smith to be his GM. That I'm not crazy about, but I guess if, like, one, it's a loyalty thing because Otis stuck with him during that whole Dwight Mara thing. And really had his back. And Otis can, I mean, you know, Otis knows the CBA. I don't know he knows how to utilize the CBA, but he knows it. And so you at least have someone in there to help you with it, and maybe hopefully Stan Van Gundy is making, you know, the final call. Well, Tom Gores will make the final call, but hopefully Stan is like can check like some of those impulses of that Otis had of like, maybe we don't need that guy, you know, but let's go for this kind of guy.
You know, I'm different on Otis than a lot of people are because people basically look at the Vince Carter trade. Signing Gilbert Arenas, and that's really like the two things, right?
Yes.
Because everyone's like, well, he signed Rashard Lewis to that insane contract. Like at the time, that was a bottom feeder franchise in a small market trying to make an immediate step forward. You have to overpay. Like you just do. And Lewis was phenomenal until about 2010.
Until about a 15-game suspension.
Anyway, let's just move on past that. He was really phenomenal. And, you know, the thing with the Carter trade, which you know, I didn't like at the time because I was anti-Vince Carter, was, you know, they didn't re-sign Hedo Turkoglu. And it was one of those, if it ain't broke, why fix it? But then you look at, like, you can't look at that and say it was bad because Hedo went and got a massive contract offer, which he was always going to get from Toronto and was horrific.
Yeah,
he got traded three times?
Yeah, he was so bad.
You know, and the Magic eventually picked him up because they were just trying to recover from what had happened. Like, they were just trying to get back to where they were. Like, maybe he'll come here and things. Basically, Hedo came up for as a free agent, and everything happened because of Turkoglu's value being exacerbated by a free agency market, which is much different now. Like, you don't have to overpay for Hedo Turkoglu now. Like, there aren't as many guys in the league that will do that. You could say Otis Smith might be one of them, but he won't be in necessarily that position. I'm not saying that Otis Smith did a good job towards the end of it. He didn't. He traded for Gilbert Arenas. Like he made terrible decisions. But what gets lost is that guy also built a finals team. He built a team that went to the finals, and you cannot sit there and say that was Dwight Howard. That team didn't win because of Dwight Howard. He was a big part of it, but they won because of largely their pick-and-roll action with Hedo Turkoglu and Dwight Howard, Jameer Nelson playing great at point guard, and Rashard Lewis killing folks from as a stretch four.
Well, also, when you look at that Vince Carter trade, the first year after that Vince Carter trade, they were second in defense and offense. Like, they were good. They went to the Eastern Conference Finals and lost to a better Celtics team.
You can argue that that was – you can argue that in 2010, that team was better than any of the ones previous. It just
– It didn't work the same way, right?
And even then, like, Boston wasn't very good. They just got super crazy great for about what? They got super crazy great for about 14 – 12 games, so about.
I think you're too hard on that team.
They were so bad the end of the regular season. Like, they were bad to start the season. They were bad the end of it.
Yeah, but I also think that there's a certain point where veteran teams like that just don't care about the regular season.
Yeah.
You know, and that doesn't excuse poor play necessarily, but it doesn't cause me to think like, oh, I don't know how that team pulled it together. Like, they pulled it together because they were a really good team.
Even then, the Magic were really great in 2010. So, like, if the Celtics, if not, they hadn't existed, things could have broken differently very easily, and the Magic could have made the finals again.
Yes.
That wouldn't have shocked me.
Right. I agree.
They were really great that season. That was prime Dwight then.
He was so good.
Like, really, when you look back at it, the Celtics' real legacy wasn't, I think, more than even that 2008 championship, is that they ruined so many teams.
Yeah. They ruined the Pistons. The Pistons were kind of at the end of their run, but they ended the Pistons.
They ruined the Pistons. They killed LeBron's Cleveland team.
Yep.
They literally drove LeBron out of Cleveland. They ended the Magic's run and blew up basically the – like, after that, that was when Dwight was like, well, I'm not going to win here. Like, that's when all the nonsense kind of started. And, like, the Heat actually were pretty good in one of the years that they faced them, and they ruined them too. Like, it just – The Boston Celtics of 2010 were the Andrew Bynum of the NBA.
Oh, Jesus. The Wizards should put the Celtics courtside for game 6.
They might have a chance to, since most of those guys may be free.
Yeah, they'll be free after tonight. I think it's interesting, like, looking at the roster they have. Like, obviously the big comparison is, well, Andre Drummond at 20 is very similar to Dwight Howard at 20, right? Like, initially it was, oh, well, Andre Drummond is their Dwight Howard now. And the blowback is, oh, Dwight Howard's so much better than Andre Drummond. It's like, right, but at 20, they're actually quite comparable. I don't know that his ceiling is as high, and I don't even really know why I would think that, but I just kind of have that feeling like, oh, I don't think he's going to be Dwight Howard. But he looks really good.
This is a huge thing that I try and get people to remember, because there's this idea, the narrative has been rewritten, it's been retconned to basically Dwight entered the league and then swatted everything and was a defensive stalwart and a wonderful defensive player. And in reality, he was bad when he was young, because playing defense in the NBA is hard.
It was a lot like watching DeAndre Jordan the two years before this season.
Yeah, and I did a blog post in the summer of 2008 about how Stan Van Gundy was basically like haranguing him, saying, you have to get better. Like, you have to get – like, Dwight Howard has to get better at defense. And he started – and he made the leap. He made the jump. So I don't think there's any reason to believe that he can't – you know, Drummond may never be – this is weird. I don't know, like, to ask – you know, is he ever going to be the offensive force? Because I kind of feel like Drummond may have a little bit more polish.
I feel like Drummond is better at offense at this age than Dwight was. But I don't know that the league has also shifted so much from, well, I mean, Dwight at that age was, what was this, 2007, 2008? Like, that's kind of when that was. So Dwight at that age versus Drummond at this age, like, the league is so different in terms of how it's played that I don't know that Drummond would have that opportunity to get the same type of touches and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to say, like, oh, yeah, he could do the same things Dwight did. Like, it's a different league now, even in that short amount of time. So that's tricky. But, I mean, if you look at the numbers, they're just numbers, but you look at the numbers, you know, Drummond has a much higher field goal percentage. Is a better rebounder, is a more efficient player. Now, he's a much worse free throw shooter, and that's going to be ultimately the key to how good he is on offense. Is, can he get around 55 to 65%? Like, that'll be the key. But in terms of, you know, just straight skill set to skill set, they're very comparable.
Dwight was 23 when they made that finals run in 09.
Yeah.
God. And even if he doesn't make Drummond into Dwight, it's still going to be – like, they're still going to have a great kind of
– Let's say you get him to 75% of Dwight. That's a really good player.
Right, and it's probably a guy that doesn't demand the ball.
Right, exactly.
And doesn't cost as much, so.
And Drummond will run the pick and roll. He doesn't have those expectations.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that you're probably not too optimistic about what he can do with Josh Smith.
Oh, my God. Here's the thing about Josh Smith. there are like five players in history who have taken as many threes as Smith in his career and shot under 29% from three-point range. That is horrific. That is – I can't even begin to describe how bad this is. And it's not that the shots are – it's not that the shots don't go. It's that they're bad decisions. And that's the problem. If they're good decisions, I can live with a missed shot. But they're bad decisions, and he's so good around the basket. He's so good in the post. He's such a good passer. And, I mean, if you can harness that stuff, I love him. But how long into this career are we? This is 8-9 seasons in? He's not changing. You can try to maximize what's left. But I mean, as good a coach as Stan Van Gundy is, I don't see this changing. Now, I liked your idea that you mentioned to me of, like, well, maybe he can be that Hedo Turkoglu type. And maybe he can. Hedo was still an important shooter for that team. But if you can get him to run the pick and roll with Drummond, if you can get him to attack and really dribble penetrate and all that stuff, like, yeah, it can work. But, I mean, defensively, having that system with Drummond and Josh Smith will be fantastic. This was the 26th best defense in the league last year. And it honestly wouldn't shock me if they were top 10 this coming season.
It's interesting because it's almost like you'll forgive gunning up until a certain point, but then it's like if you're so bad at shooting, it's like the reverse is true. Like you turn violently hard against the gunning.
Yeah, because gunning, there has to be a reward to gunning. And that's the thing. Like, as crazy as J.R. Smith and Nick Young make people, there has to be a reward. And there is a reward with those guys enough to where you can not justify it, but like pretend justify it, right? You can't do that with Josh. He's under 29% for his career.
Right. 40% from the field and 33% from three is fine, but not 40% from the field and 29% from three.
Exactly.
I mentioned Brandon Jennings. I don't know how this is going to work. I don't know that Jennings is going to – I don't know how he's going to respond to SVG because SVG is not going to tolerate what he – like, I would not be shocked if he got benched, if he had to come off the bench. I would not be surprised if the Pistons drafted a point guard and then Jennings has to come off the bench, because if you don't make good decisions and you don't commit to what SVG asks you to do, he's not going to put up with it. And he's got power now.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing is, and it's, oh, well, what's he going to do with Josh Smith? What's he going to do with Brandon Jennings? Like, well, now he doesn't have any pressure to keep, you know, to play those guys. Right. He's the guy in charge. He'll put them on the bench if they're not willing to play the style and the way he wants. And so that's kind of the cool thing about him, is that there is no pressure. The pressure will come from the owner, but he can convince the owner, hey, did you see what Joe Dumars did with this contract situation? Like, we got to get away from that.
I still think the owner is very big on Josh Smith. I think that
probably is, yeah.
I think he's very big on Josh Smith, and that's – I think Josh may have a little bit of insulation.
It makes sense, too, because think of the rebounding opportunities for Greg Monroe and Andre Drummond every time Josh Smith puts up a shot.
Yeah, I think Monroe's gone. I think they're going to do a sign and trade.
It's so tricky with restricted free agency. What do you think of the idea of them matching whatever comes, keeping him for a year, and seeing if they can work those two together within the system? And then if it doesn't work, you move Monroe in a year.
I think patience is stupid. So I prefer big life-changing moves that bring us lots of things to write about. So I would much prefer that they exercise no patience and completely make a knee-jerk reaction to everything that's happened.
If anything, they should just start They should start soiling his name in the media right now.
Exactly. I mostly, to be perfectly honest with you, I want a sign and trade, and I gotta remember how the sign and trade dynamics work, but I want a sign and trade that basically sends him to Denver. That's what I want.
Yeah, it's gotta be before, I mean, he can't agree to an offer sheet with Denver and then work out a sign and trade. It's all gotta be worked out before.
Yep. It's tricky, but that to me is the ideal scenario, not just because I love Moose and want to cover him, but they want a back to the basket scorer. They've got things that they can move. Tim Connelly wants to make a big splash. If they add a responsible veteran, which is something that they're really going to gear for, and they add Greg Monroe as a player for Shaw to work with, I think that works really well. And I think there's a lot of pieces that Denver has that would make sense.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially for Sam Van Gundy. I mean, particularly, I know he's coming off the ACL injury.
I was just going to say, Gallo.
Gallo makes a lot of sense there.
Gallo would look great in Van Gundy's offense.
Like, Gallo becomes Hidu. Josh Smith becomes Rashard Lewis.
Ooh, yikes.
And I mean, we got to back out of this a little bit because we've seen this before where, like, you can't translate, like, Rick Adelman, you know, the Wolves. We were like, oh, well, let's go like the Kings. And, like, that, you know, it wasn't like, it was more like the Rockets.
And, right. And kind of a similar thing with, and this is an extreme case, but D'Antoni with the Lakers, right? It was like, yeah. Oh, how do these pieces fit into what he does? It's like, well, it's not that simple.
Yeah, it doesn't really work that way. I'm very excited for the possibility of Jonas Jerebko having a career again. That would be exciting.
Yeah.
I love him.
It's only like 70-something attempts, but he did shoot 40% from three last year after, I think he's like a career like 32% shooter or something like that. But
he plays really hard. And
maybe
for some
reason, potential there.
He plays really hard, and for some reason, coaches have just hated him. I don't know what – I don't really get it. Like, he doesn't play dumb to me. He doesn't make bad decisions. He seems to play within himself. I don't get it.
Yeah, so. Is he a bad defender? I don't feel like he is, but maybe I just don't watch them closely enough.
I don't think so. He gives – I don't know. He gives good effort regardless of what he does. So, yeah, let's talk about games tonight because you got a video coming up.
Oh, I do. Oh, yes, I do. Just real quick, Rashard Lewis and Josh Smith. I just wanted to compare. Rashard Lewis, career-wise, shoots 10.3% better from three-point range. Just wanted to throw that out there.
Well, that's a perfect comparison. Well. Heater minus 7.5 at home tonight.
I think the Nets will make it close again for most of this game. I think the Heat will pull away, win by 8 or 9. I wouldn't feel good about betting that line, but I think that's about right.
Paul Pierce should have kept his mouth shut.
Here's what I wouldn't do. I wouldn't poke the bear in the cage. Because the bear gets out, he rips your face off. LeBron is shooting in this series like something like he's shooting 82% in the restricted area. 82%.
We're not scared of these guys. Maybe you should be.
You don't have to be scared, but just don't run your mouth. Don't say yeah.
A little bit of fear is healthy, Paul.
Don't say yeah, I wanted him. He keeps beating you. This isn't 2009 anymore. This is 2010.
Yeah, I wanted him because you're a masochist? Yeah. I think they win. I think they're done screwing around. I'll take the Heat minus 7.
I'm a little wary that might be too big, but I think it's about right. I think they win by like 8 or 9.
I think also the Nets I think might be broken. But then I thought the Wizards would be broken and they came back. So
yeah.
Spurs are minus 8.
They should win, right?
It would be interesting. Barkley said it and it kind of did catch my ears. Like, it would be kind of interesting if the Blazers forced this thing back to game 6 in Portland. They won 2 straight, headed back to game 6 in Portland. I took the Spurs because you don't want to feel stupid about doubting them.
Right.
You get tired of picking them every time, but
it's – I mean, they're picked every time for a reason. They're really good.
Yeah, they're better.
Yeah, they're a better team. They're better coached, and that's not a knock on the Blazers. It's just you're not there yet.
Right.
And I mean, up 3-0 – you don't lose in the NBA. You just don't.
Yep.
And you know, I don't know how often it ends in 5 when they're up 3-0, but I would guess it's more than half the time. And so just the odds are in the Spurs' favor in many ways.
Yeah, and I didn't feel like – I guess part of it was I didn't feel like the Spurs played well and the Blazers played well and the Blazers beat them. I just felt like the Blazers played well and the Spurs had an off game because they played three tremendous games. And yeah. You know, I mean, it makes a little bit more sense that they're gonna, for them to win in five than a sweep. Like, we didn't think the Blazers were that bad, so.
Yeah. Well, going in, I thought I picked Spurs in seven because yeah. I just – that Dallas series rattled me. And then oh, look, the Spurs are still the Spurs.
I am enjoying the Will Barton experience.
This Will Barton experience is fun. It's much more fun than the Mo Williams experience.
And he's going to be back. That's the other reason I think the Spurs win. Mo's back for game five. Is Mo Williams the Andrew Bynum of the Portland?
The Wizards should... No, never mind.
But Will Barton, Thomas Robinson, TJ McCollum, I think I like the fact that Stotts was like, let's put the kids out there and see what happens.
That's a fun future bench unit. You
need guys that are too dumb to know better. That's the best way to attack the Spurs.
And you can't have
guys that are like...
You throw in Darrell Wright. I like Darrell Wright a lot as a role player. Like, you throw him in there to that unit, that's a good 9-man rotation in the future.
I think I will say one of the interesting things in the series, the inability to get splitter in foul trouble is a problem for Portland.
It's shocking, really.
It's one of the things that when you face San Antonio, you need. Like, you've got to be able to get splitter in foul trouble.
I have a question for you. Do you feel like splitter is defending LaMarcus that much better than the Ashiq Dwight Howard combo did?
Because I do.
Because I was looking, because I had this post that I was going to work on for like how the Rockets were defending LaMarcus, but I was going to wait until a game seven to get as much info. So I had like the first five games broken down and just never got to it because they ended it in six. But so I felt like I had a good handle on how those guys were defending them. And then I look at this and I'm like, and I'm not trying to take anything away from Splitter because I think he's done a fantastic job, but I really thought Ashiq and Howard did a good job. Like I thought they contested well. I thought he just hit shots. Like, I thought he was just better, and he's not necessarily hitting the same shots, but he's also taking a few more tougher shots.
Yeah, that's part of it. Is against I thought Howard did great against Ashiq. He kind of figured out that he can out of the post up, he could spin baseline and get free.
Yeah.
Like, Ashiq is really big, but he doesn't move. He moves laterally well when he's moving, but there's inertia because he's bigger, right? Like, yeah, he doesn't...
You got to get that body moving first.
He doesn't translate to lateral movement as fast as Dwight does or as fast as Splitter does. Splitter's done a really good job of basically forcing him away from the baseline, which is big because his baseline jumper is lethal. You got to make sure you cut off that baseline. I mean, I say this all the time anyway, but... Make him go back over that left shoulder, and hit you, and beat you that way. That's been the thing. The difference for me.
It's like my grandpa always said: you got to get that train chugging if you're going to contest a shot. He said that.
Is his grandmother the Andrew Bynum of Wizards? Should put his money.
Yeah, I was curious what you thought about Splitter's defense because I know he's defending better, but I was just trying to figure out the degree of how much better you think it is.
I wouldn't say it hasn't been day and night. Like, Thiago Splitter is really good and worth the contract that he got and a great player for the Spurs team, but, you know, he's not an elite defensive player, especially he's really good in the post, better than he is in most places, but he's not as good as a lot of guys are.
Yeah. But he's, I would say he's stepped up his game and he's just damn effective now.
Yeah, and he's also just killing them all over the floor too. Like, he's just involved in so much. Like, he's one of those guys that's been everywhere. I always talk about it in series as those guys that the other team the fans just can't believe is killing them. Like, you expect Tim Duncan, you expect Tony Parker, you expect Manu Ginobili, but then you're like, God, Thiago Splitter?
It was kind of that way with Danny Green last year, right? It was like, how is Danny Green doing all this? Like, he was one of those guys as well.
Get beat by Danny Green. God. So Also, important reminder, role players play well round to round. They'll have a bad one and then a good one and then maybe another good one and then a bad one. It's inconsistent round to round. The star players are the guys that are consistent. That's why they wind up winning you games. So, you know, Marco Bellinelli really struggled in the first round. He's played really well in the second round. We'll see what he does in the third. So,
yep.
Thanks, Zach.
Thanks, Matt.